Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to Tech Tuesday from All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. From sports to news, there's a new player in how we consume and interact with the world around us: online betting and prediction markets. What started as a simple overturn of a sports betting ban has turned into a partnership between one of the world's biggest prediction markets, Kalshi, and one of the world's biggest news sources, CNN. What does this partnership mean, and how have prediction markets grown so much? Joining us now is Nina Bombesheva, deputy editor at Forbes. Welcome to the show, Nina.
Hi, Amy. Thank you for having me.
So what do betting and prediction markets like Kalshi, there's another one called Polymarket, what do they allow you to do? And can you explain how they make money?
Right. They allow you to simply bet on things. And with prediction markets in particular, they allow you to bet virtually on everything. Although now we see that state regulators in particular question that definition and say that they are more like sports betting platforms, although they are regulated by the CFTC as future contracts. How do they make money? Well, it is a big question even for us now, because these platforms became big in 2024, and most of the time since they've spent on growing, they've raised massive amounts of capital. It is famous that Polymarket doesn't generate revenue now. The CEO, Shane Copeland, said, "Oh, we're famously losing money." And Kalshi does charge fees, but it is also a big question for them. So I think part of what we see in the headlines with all the partnerships that they're announcing is also the real need to diversify and find that revenue channel.
How old are these companies? I mean, are they young companies or are they new to the business? Like, what, where do they come from?
Well, they've actually been around for 5 or 7 years. Prediction markets in general aren't a new phenomenon. They trace back, if you look closely, into you know, centuries ago, when people were making bets on who would be the next pope. In the 90s, they became this electronic digital version when universities began experimenting with these types of contracts. So current prediction markets, it really started, I think, with Polymarket here, which is a blockchain-based prediction platform, which launched in 2020. Over the pandemic, but they gained popularity really in 2024 in the run-up to the presidential elections.
And a part of the reason they gained in popularity is certain states allowed betting on wider scales, right? So are there still states where they're not allowed to operate, or is it kind of almost nationwide now?
Well, it is an interesting question. I think in general, betting and prediction markets have been disallowed generally because they were considered gambling platforms. Kalshi actually gained the first CFTC recognition only recently, and so far has been the only large regulated U.S. regulated prediction market. Polymarket started operating in the U.S. but was forced to shut down its U.S. operations and is only now coming back to the States. And it is a question that is only now, I think, being discussed at a state level because these platforms got so big. So in recent weeks, we've seen states like Nevada and Connecticut saying that prediction platforms like Kalshi are essentially sports betting platforms. And Kalshi, of course, disputes that by saying we are regulated nationwide, so this doesn't apply to us.
Yeah. I mean, in Ohio, for example, we allow sports betting. It's kind of more recent, but it's been allowed. And the governor now wants to close Pandora's box. He wishes he wouldn't have opened it. But I guess it's here to stay. So is something like Kalshi and Polymarket allowed to operate in a state like Ohio if we allow sports betting?
Well, I think that is a question for the lawyers, really, because it is, they are so new. I mean, in the way they got so big and are getting this attention. So I think this will be discussed and disputed at a regulatory level, both state and nationwide. But another interesting point here to make, I think, is New York State, just in 2024, made over $1 billion in tax revenue from sports betting, right? So I think they also look at these platforms as potential, you know, tax revenue sources, and they want to be able to have a say in overseeing them. So that is also, I think, a very important point to consider.
Yeah, I think Ohio lawmakers probably like the additional tax dollars, but maybe don't like all of the publicity that they got about prop bets and a couple of baseball players here in Ohio. So, you know, that kind of thing. We mentioned that Kalshi and Polymarket are two of the biggest ones. Are there others competing with them, or is it just those two companies?
Well, it really started a whole wave. We've seen Robinhood launch prediction markets, a few others. Coinbase, a large crypto exchange, is also venturing into prediction markets. Interactive Brokers, interestingly, said they wanted to acquire Kalshi a few years ago. So all these large fintechs or platforms that are trying to be the all-in-one shops are thinking about it in some shape or form. And on the other hand, there are large institutions who are also looking at these as, you know, revenue sources. Well, so we've seen Susquehanna International Group partner with Kalshi as their market maker. I've heard of other large crypto platforms that are thinking about ways to do that. So yeah, it is a big new trend that I think everyone's paying attention to.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about the rise of prediction markets with the deputy editor at Forbes, Nina Bambashiba. So I wanted to move on to what I mentioned at the beginning. CNN and Kalshi recently announced a partnership between the two companies are partnering. What does this mean for them? So now we're betting on the news. Is that what's happening?
I like to think of it as these platforms smartly recognize that everything is a market and everything is a distribution platform. And you can really see it in how they've grown so far. They've surrounded themselves not only with powerful investors, many of whom are billionaires, have, you know, people like Donald Trump Jr. and former CFTC chairs and commissioners on their boards, but also partnerships like, you know, CNN, CNBC. We've seen Polymarket partner with ICE, who invested $2 billion in them. ICE is a parent company of the New York Stock Exchange, of course. And it is interesting also to see, I think, how these two rivals are moving sort of in similar but different directions. So Kalshi has partnered with traditional media, and Polymarket has partnered with X. I do think they also have a partnership with Yahoo Finance. So it is also kind of just going into areas where there are rivals not there yet. Or Kalshi, for instance, is now growing in crypto, traditionally Polymarket's turf, because they've been the blockchain-based prediction market. As to what it means, it's not only, I think, to do that to grow their brand recognition, but as I mentioned before, it is the real business need to diversify. Maybe it will be, you know, licensing brands or some other types of ways to monetize and sell their data. So we've yet to see all this play out even bigger.
Many critics and experts have critiqued the increased popularity of prediction markets and called it casino-fying everyday interactions and even world events. What's your take on this? Are we casino-fying everything in life?
I think so. We I think have seen this play out all the way back from the pandemic with, trends like GameStop and the Wall Street Bets crowd with meme coins in crypto. They've been a huge phenomenon. Now, not so much, but it was at some point a market worth over $100 billion. And I think the accessibility of investing that probably Robinhood kickstarted this wave in a major way, and now is also moving into prediction markets. And people just wanting to invest because they recognize that the traditional ways of providing security for yourself and for your family aren't that reliable anymore. One of the angel investors in Robinhood has called this the degenerate economy phenomenon, and he even has a degenerate economy index with companies like Robinhood and Coinbase that are comprising this to just show how big this has become.
So with one of these prediction markets partnering with CNN and probably and more partnerships to come, and you mentioned a few others, is this going to impact the way the news is delivered?
We shall see, but I think you're already starting to see this happen. I mean, some people on X talk about how they don't really check news anymore. They go to prediction markets, and the elections were a big catalyst for that. Even I would start my day with, opening one of these platforms and seeing what the chances are of a certain candidate winning. If not changing, all the way how we consume news and think about them, at least you will have those, tickers and brands out there, and you will pay attention to predictions, really.
Do you think that predictions for events like elections will become more reliant on businesses like Kalshi to forecast what's happening? Like, are they're going to get? I'm sure people have always been betting on elections, but this it's just going to become more and more of a thing, kind of the way everyone's betting on every pitch of a baseball game.
I think so, but also at the same time, there are new questions that, well, they aren't necessarily new, but I think people are forced to think about them deeper, like insider trading. There were a few instances with prediction markets where I think someone, the day before Taylor Swift announced her engagement, placed a huge bet on that, and people started talking about how it probably was an insider or someone with knowledge. Or also one of the prediction markets called the Nobel Peace Prize winner hours before it was announced. So that is another question, a really interesting question here. And people argue, well, the product that prediction markets are selling is truth, quote unquote. And so that insider trading is kind of, a feature, not a bug, because all you want at the end is accurate information. If this allows you to get that information quicker than anywhere else, then that's the way. But on the other hand, if these platforms are moving and changing finance, the way they say, it is an important trend and really phenomenon to consider.
Yeah, how do you police someone in Taylor Swift's circle not betting on her? Like
Exactly.
I that's fascinating. But also Taylor Swift has such a tight circle. I am shocked that that got out. Okay. So, what is the end goal of these prediction markets? I feel like they're just going to keep growing. Is there an end goal?
The end goal, I think, for them is to be to, have a contract on everything. Well, they say they want to be the ultimate source of truth. What does that mean? You gotta ask them. But I think you see it in the way they are just eating into everything: finance, traditional media, social media, and it is a race to to be, you know, this the source, the major source of information. It is interesting, by the way, I think coming back to our topic, how when they last year, the CEOs of these platforms were saying, well, we are a better alternative to traditional media. No one reads news anymore. And here you have prediction markets. So they wanted to, you know, be the perfect substitute. And now you see them partnering with the very traditional media they were criticizing.
Fascinating. All right, we'll see where it expands. We've been talking about the expanding world of betting with Nina Bombasheva, deputy editor at Forbes. Thank you so much for your time today, Nina.
Thank you, Amy.
Coming up, we are going to talk about using technology to help those who can't speak be able to communicate. That is when Tech Tuesday from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday from All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This is a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. In a world where communication is seen as the key to success and happiness, the ability to speak is widely taken for granted. While a vast majority of the population is verbal, those who are, for whatever reason, nonverbal often rely on AAC. The acronym stands for Augmentative and Alternative Communication. And it is often misrepresented and even frowned upon by those who do not understand it. To help us learn more about the uses of AAC resources and how they help people with verbal disabilities, we have Amy Suntog, a speech-language pathologist and clinical associate professor at Ohio State University. Welcome to All Sides, Amy.
Great. Thank you so much.
So let's start with AAC, which I said stands for augmentative and alternative communication. So I understand what alternative communication means, but let's do the other word. What does the augmentative part mean?
That's a great question. I think a lot of people think of it as an either or, that you are either using some sort of system to communicate or you're using your voice. And in reality, we want to look at all of the means someone has to communicate that we all use every day. Facial expressions, gestures, eye gaze, just to something in your environment, that special look with someone you know well, where you have an entire conversation and a look, all of that is augmentative types of communication. And one of the things we can add to that for people who cannot use their voice is as much are different types of technology that we can put in place that gives someone voice output through that technology.
Okay, can you give me some examples of that technology? What are devices people use?
Yes, the first ones really came out in the 80s and look pretty archaic now compared to today's standards. They didn't even have computer-looking type screens, but you might press a button that has a picture or a word or a combination, and then it would speak in a very robot type of voice. Those systems have really improved over the past 30, 40 years, close to, you know, getting closer to 50 years. The industry is really moving forward. And now that technology looks a lot like an iPad, might be on an iPad or an iPhone, or has from specialized companies that will give you lots of different options on how to put language into pictures or into various chunks of your life so that you can put commonly used messages together and be more effective in communicating with, say, a medical provider or your family members or a friend or at a coffee shop or a restaurant.
And something I read about that I didn't really know about are some misconceptions about AAC and the nonverbal community. Like an example that I read was that parents are sometimes worried about giving their kid a device to use because they're worried that they won't ever learn to speak, as an example.
Yes, I'm so glad you brought that up. It is one of the prevalent myths still today. And what we have found and what research is showing is that putting AAC in place will help someone improve their ability to communicate verbally faster if they're going to have the ability to do that. And I've seen that in my clinical work over and over and over again, not just with kids, but with adults. We've got some clients that we are working with in our clinic in the Department of Speech and Hearing Science who have aphasia, and even though they might be 10, 15 years out from a stroke or possibly TBI, putting a communication device in place that gives them a way to communicate in a way their voice wouldn't, they start using some more verbal speech. They may not be able to meet all of their communication needs verbally, but they have more ability to enhance what their voice can do. It's not a guarantee, but there is no research that shows that the use of augmentative and alternative communication is going to stop someone from learning or regaining that speech.
Tell me what aphasia is.
Oh, great, great question. So aphasia is if you have difficulty communicating because of a stroke. That might be that the word that you're thinking doesn't come out, or that it doesn't come out the way you want it to come out. So your speech might all of a sudden not be as crisp and clear and able to be understood as it used to be. And so putting that technology in place can help. Some people actually lose that ability to speak with aphasia, or they can only say a few commonly used phrases that they used to say. So this gives them the ability to use more and more communication to be more independent.
So adding in this device can actually help people speak who cannot, but it also be a bridge between what, as you're working with a speech language pathologist to with your speech, it's a bridge in between?
It can be. It's not always a bridge. We don't ever want to promise someone that they will regain their speech. But I think the big takeaway is it's not going to stop someone from being able to communicate verbally in the future if those other techniques that might improve verbal communication are put in place.
Aside from those who are nonverbal, children are often regarded as the most difficult to communicate with in a medical setting. So what ways does AAC help remedy that, the children who just won't communicate?
That's a great question. I think what we want to do before the child gets into that doctor's appointment is give them that autonomy to be able to communicate. One of the things that we know from research is the most studied population with augmentative and alternative communication are people with autism. And a lot of that research is focused on them just requesting and getting what they want. And while getting what you want is important, it doesn't give you the ability to have all of those other means of communication, such as telling someone what you think about something, how you feel, something that may hurt. And so I think before we get a child into that doctor's office, we need to give them a way to communicate more than just requests so that they know that their communication has power and that they have autonomy in what they want to say and they will be heard.
Talk to me about funding of these devices. Can people afford them? Are they paid for with insurance?
That's a great question. And I this is a constantly changing landscape. Mm-hmm. Currently, Ohio Medicaid is a very good funder of communication devices. And Medicare is a good funder of communication devices. Private insurance varies. Some of them don't fund at all. Some may fund up to 80% once you've met your deductible and you're out of, sometimes you're out of pocket max. If you've met that out of pocket max, then you will be able to get a communication device funded. But that's where I think advancing technologies in other areas, especially in a landscape where the funding could be changing, is really important. And so the more we can get this type of technology in someone's hands at a lower cost and to be able to be used, especially if someone doesn't have access to a speech language pathologist, to just know what this technology is and can do, can be really important to increase awareness and that someone might have seen something and go, huh, I know someone who communicated like that once, so maybe my person could do that as well.
Yeah, you mentioned that a lot of these devices are funded through Medicaid and Medicare. We know that there's changes coming, especially over the next 10 years. There's going to be a big reduction in Medicaid. So do you worry about people not having access to these devices?
I do. I do worry. And that's where I really am looking a lot and helping the work I do with students find options that are much lower cost or free. There are many more free apps for AAC that are available. They might not have all the same features, the same support that a dedicated communication device company will give, but if someone doesn't have access to that funding to have that as an option, it's really important to know what is available and is out there. And I love that today's students that are in undergrad and graduate programs in augmentative for various types of rehab are learning about augmentative and alternative communication now so they can bring that out into their work as they graduate in the future.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about nonverbal communication with Amy Sundtag, speech-language pathologist and clinical associate professor at Ohio State University. So from what I heard, your organization where you work has had some recent successes with turning an iPhone into one of these devices. So that's, I mean, if you have a phone, that, you know, then you don't need an additional piece of technology. Right. Okay, so tell me about that.
So the accessibility and the features in the iPhone have always been pretty good overall. One of the things that's happening more, especially since iOS 17, we're now on version 26, but it really went 17, 18, 26. So there were a lot of numbers that were were skipped in there. But one of the things that really started to happen is the ability to do more accessibility for someone who can't touch their phone, to be able to control their phone if you have the ability to speak with your voice. But more importantly, if you don't have that ability to speak, how to move your head to move a cursor on your iPhone and make a selection on the iPhone. And also, if you have the ability to touch a screen, like maybe you have Parkinson's disease, but your fingers are still able to touch your iPhone or your iPad or another piece of technology, having something where you can type and it will speak aloud. Mm-hmm. One of the things the iPhone did is they put something called live speech right into the phone, where it will give you a keyboard and you can save your own phrases, pre-programmed phrases, and be able to communicate that in that way.
So what are you, can you tell me like what you've been doing with the iPhone and teaching your students? And I mean, have you been working with Apple? Like, who tells Apple what to do?
That's actually a great question. Actually, I wouldn't claim I'm working directly with Apple, but I was at a, I've had some conversations and emails that I've sent to the accessibility team at Apple, and actually some really motivated students have done the same thing. There has been someone that has paired with our university, Tom Meadows, who had a friend who had ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, which is a degenerative condition, neurological condition, and his friend didn't have access to a good communication device evaluation. And so he found ways in the iPhone to make this work, but it took 45 different steps and multiple menus to get this all set up. And so he has done a lot of advocacy work with Apple's accessibility team. We sort of tagged in, probably did a tiny fraction of what he did, and we don't really know what happened and where the impetus was, but iOS 26 came out and boom, they've got a feature where within a few steps, you can now turn on head tracking where you can move your head to be able to move a cursor on the screen and then look at something for a set amount of time, and then it will make that activation, or even eye gaze where you just move your eyes if you don't have as much movement for your eyes, for your body.
So if someone cannot speak, but they want to communicate, they can use their iPhone with iOS 26 now.
They can, yes.
You wanted to give me an example of that?
Well, one of the other things that I think is really important for people who don't need AAC now, whether you don't know where your life is going to go in the future. If you might end up in a car accident or have a stroke or Parkinson's, ALS, one of the important things I think is to voice bank. And that used to be a very expensive process. It's now very simple to voice bank for free. There are companies called such as Acapella where you can bank your voice for free. You then have to pay later to use it if you need to use it. But then when you have a voice, it sounds like your own. It's not as robotic. And iOS, though, has a feature where in iOS 18, you had to record 150 phrases and it would create a personal voice for you. You can now create that in 10 phrases. So I thought I'd just demo, you've been hearing me talk, what my voice sounds like that I created on the iPhone.
Hi, my name is Amy Sundtag. I work at The Ohio State University.
So it's a little computery, but it's...
It sounds like you. Yeah.
It's the essence of me. And I think that's really important to do now. And that will live in my iPhone, in my iPad, on my iPlatforms to be able to do that. If someone doesn't have an iPhone, more and more of that is coming out. It is possible to use on Android technology. Those costs may vary, but I think it's really exciting that the iOS has just built all this directly into it. It lives in your pocket if you have that device.
Let's talk about you for a minute. What drew you to the science of speech and hearing? How did you end up a speech language pathologist?
Well, at the time, I actually, when I went to school, the only career for me to really work in that I knew of in this area of AAC was speech language pathology. And speech language pathologists, we do many things from language and cognition to swallowing to articulation. But this is really the area I wanted to do because I grew up with a friend who had cerebral palsy and we grew up together. She could not communicate with her voice. She had a lot of physical disabilities that she was in a wheelchair, but her speech language pathologists were always the ones that found ways for she and I to be able to communicate with one another. And as I grew up, I would tag along with her occupational therapist, her physical therapist, and her speech therapist, but it was always her speech therapist that was finding a way for she and I to be friends, to be able to really communicate and have that friendship, even though it wasn't in the same way a friend of mine who was able to speak with their voice all the time would have been able to do. And so I think about, her name is Carrie, and I think about her often as I have moved through this field working clinically and then moving into the more of the academic side where I'm still doing clinical work, but doing it with students to prepare them for this work in the future so that more and more people who are not able to communicate with their voice, that students who are our future providers know that this technology is available and can take it out into their careers.
Great story. I love knowing that. We found out about you because we read a story about you and your work with ALS patients. Mm-hmm. Is that a focus right now, or is that just happened to be one story that happened to be out there?
So I don't do as much work with ALS patients as much as I work with the students to know what the technology is available when they go into their outside placements. They do clinical work with me in the first year of the program, and most of the people I see in our clinic have we have an aphasia initiative in our clinic, and the people that we see in that aphasia initiative who use AAC will often see me as well to work on their communication skills. Mm-hmm. But one of the things I want to do with our students through their clinic and classic experiences is to have them ready to go out into their placements when they're working in other clinics that have a specialty in ALS to be able to tell the other speech language pathologists and the family members that this technology exists and is able to be used for their families. But part of the research team I'm working with, we're really looking at are AAC outcomes for various populations, and people with ALS are definitely part of that population. So one would think it's easy to know that, oh, well, the outcome is important communication. But I think what we're seeing is the research isn't as clear or as consistent on what does an outcome mean. And so that's what we really want to dig down to for people with ALS, Parkinson's, autism, cerebral palsy, Down syndrome, and a variety of other diagnoses that require communication devices.
Right. And this whole idea of being able to record 10 phrases and have it sound like you, I could see with someone, because ALS, you know, increases over time.
Exactly.
So if someone tells them when they're diagnosed, they can record it in advance and before they lose their voice.
Definitely.
Right?
Okay. Definitely.
My understanding is there's a shortage of speech language pathologists, right? How do you, you work with students every day. How do you keep them in the field?
Wow, that's a great question I hadn't thought about. So I think some of it is helping them see the value in what they're doing and understanding where the field is now and where some of those potential challenges are, and learning not just how to do the job, but how to advocate for your patients. Like, it is very much about you care about someone's ability to communicate, and so you want to help them communicate. But it's more than making that argument that it's the right thing to do. How do you help build that advocacy of the financial argument to your employer as to why we might need to hire someone else and why if we can get someone else in, we can improve outcomes for people and save money and improve outcomes in the long run. Advocate to various community organizations to continue to have speech-language pathology services, how to improve communication partner training in all areas. So when there aren't SLPs, we've got trained everyday people that understand that not everyone communicates the same way, and it might look different, but that doesn't mean that that person doesn't have something valuable to say. They might just say it in a different way.
We've been talking about nonverbal communication with Amy Sundtag, speech-language pathologist and clinical associate professor at Ohio State University. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, we are going to be back with a holiday gift guide from our resident tech expert, Russell Hawley, and that is when Tech Tuesday from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Gift buying season is in full swing, and parents, friends, and family are all looking for unique ideas. This week, our resident tech expert, Russell Hawley, is back with his annual gift guide, and we are going to start with some tech ideas for some kids in your life, and then later, we'll talk about some gifts that are more adult-focused. Russell Hawley is the Director of Commerce Content for CNET. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So I want to start off our gift guide this week. This is a gift for kids or kids at heart. The Nintendo Switch 2. We've talked about this numerous times on the show. Why should people give a Switch 2 if they already have a Switch 1? I guess would be my first question.
Oh, you know, that's such a good question. You know, that we are not quite at a point where there are a ton of games that are only being made for the Switch 2 right now. Like, there are quite a few games that exist for both platforms. So if you own a Switch 1, then that transition isn't super urgent. It's also true that if you own a Switch 2, a lot of the things like controllers and other accessories, you can just move over and work. So if you already have a favorite controller and you're not really interested in you know, kind of moving on to something else, you don't really have to. And the same goes if you take a Nintendo Switch 2 into a house with people who have an original Nintendo Switch, then, you know, they can join whatever game you're playing just mm-hmm. by, you know, adding their controller to it. So it's less about replacing one with the other and more about, you know, slowly kind of future-proofing the games that you really enjoy and being able to play with friends. But, you know, there are lots of reasons to consider upgrading, especially, you know, the sort of general wear and tear on consoles. The Switch 2 has been demonstrated in multiple cases to be more durable than the original version of the console. Not as durable as the Nintendo Switch Lite, which was built specifically for kids. And I have personally thrown one down a flight of stairs and it's been fine. But, you know, kids drop stuff all the time. So making sure that those things, are easier to control is interesting. Having the larger screen and, you know, kind of, you know, more capable gaming system just means that this system will last a little longer. But it really just depends on the kind of games you play. If you like playing, Mario Kart and things like that, then maybe this isn't ready, you know, time for you to like must upgrade. But it's certainly something that you'll likely be thinking about in the next little while. And, the Nintendo Switch 2 is one of the very few things that Nintendo made that isn't getting a tariff hike this year. Mm-hmm. The same cannot be said for next year.
Okay. So if you have a Switch 1, you're probably okay to stay with it. But if you're looking to get a gift for a kid in your life who doesn't have a Switch, go with the 2. Get the 2. So be ready for
that.
That
would be my recommendation, yeah.
And then what about stock issues? Because after the original launch, did we have enough of them? Do we...
There was a little bit of trouble getting a hold of a Switch 2 after it first released, but Nintendo worked really hard to make sure that, you know, that wasn't a problem for particularly long. And outside of, you know, like a big Black Friday sale or something like that, it's been pretty easy to walk into a store and find one, or, you know, head to Best Buy's, you know, website or Walmart or something like that and find them to order.
And you mentioned the price. It stayed steady. There hasn't been like a tariff increase, but what is the price of a Switch 2 right now?
So you can get $450 if you just want the console and the controller, but they do also sell a bundle with Mario Kart World that is $50 more. So you pay $500. This is an interesting distinction because if you buy the game separately, it is $70. So you are saving $20 by getting two if you are the kind of person to enjoy playing Mario Kart. Mario Kart is not for everyone. It is a fairly aggressive racing game that not everybody enjoys. So if that's your thing, I would recommend going with the bundle and saving $20, but it is not necessary.
All right, moving on. There is a STEM robot building kit. Is it a
A
Yukifa? A
Koopa.
Koopa. Okay, I should never guess.
Alpha,
I don't know.
yeah.
Whatever. So, can you tell us a bit about this robot?
Yeah, so this is a kit aimed for kids between 8 and 12, and it is designed to teach them how to build a robot out of what is basically Legos, although we don't use the L word when talking about things that are not officially licensed by that company. So it is snapped together blocks and treads and things like that with a very simple wiring harness and you know, some instructions that pair to either a remote control or an app on your phone, and allow you to you know, essentially learn how to not only assemble this robot but program it to do basic things. So if you want, after you've built it, there is software that allows you to teach it to, you know, patrol a hallway if, you know, you're you know, having fun with things like that, where it will engage based on motion sensors and things like that. It also has a fairly expressive face, which is a lot of fun for kids to be able to play with you know, kind of angry eyebrows and things like that are incredibly reminiscent of the film Short Circuit, for folks who are my age.
What ages did you say this kit is for?
8 to 12.
8 to 12. Okay. And so for our listeners out there, the word that I butchered that I don't know how to say, for when you look it up, it's AUKFA. And
That's right.
it's a STEM robot building kit. And the robot is pretty cute. I thought it looked really fun for a kid in your life. It is Lego-esque. So it looks like a what how did you call to say not Lego? You said block
Oh,
building.
just snap together blocks,
Snap
yeah.
together blocks.
It
Okay.
will look very familiar.
Yeah.
And I certainly don't know this from experience, but if you were to attach Lego pieces that you already own to it, nobody will stop you.
You would never do such a thing, right?
No, not once.
But it was reasonably priced too. Tell us about the price. Yeah.
Yeah, so this is you know, this has been on sale in various places. I think when it first came out, it was around $100, but I think Best Buy right now has it for 45.
Yeah, so super fun idea. Another one for those STEM-oriented kids is a DJI Neo Mini drone. Tell me about why there's lots of drones out there. Why this drone?
Yeah, so this one is really for a bunch of different age ranges. This is something that, you know, DJI as a company, this is something we talked about a couple of weeks ago. They are a Chinese company that may or may not be able to sell drones here for particularly long, depending on how that ends up working as we move into the new year. But the tech that goes into these drones has always been really impressive. DJI has made several larger drones that have done things like be able to follow behind you as you know, go on a hike through the woods, and it uses facial recognition tech to make sure that it is, you know, following you very specifically. There are some really impressive videos of people running, you know, through woods, and this thing, you know, like, you know, weaving in and out of trees to make sure that it stays focused on you and capturing really impressive video at the same time. As the name suggests, the mini drone is a much smaller version of one of these drones, which means the battery does not last particularly long, and it doesn't work quite as well in like really intense weather. But if it's a really lovely day at a beach, or you know, a hike through the woods or something like that, you can take some really cool photos and videos with these things.
Now, this is not as affordable and reasonably priced as the robot we were just talking about. I mean, drones, a good one, are expensive, but the mini one, how much can you get it for?
The mini one's actually on sale for $160, which is by far the lowest price we have seen for these. And I'm sure that that is in some way because DJI has a vested interest in selling as many of these as quickly as possible. But as far as a drone that is really easy to use and like genuinely enjoyable to experience, this is 100% one that I would recommend for almost any age, really.
Yeah. There's a lot of different drones out there. I mean, when I went to look up this one in particular, the internet tried to sell me a lot of others. So,
Yes.
so is there a reason? I mean, this company they're really good at drones, just the federal government doesn't like them right now because they're from
A
China.
lot of it comes down to the software. There are tons of different companies out there that make drones, and the drones can do very simple things, but the ability to do things like identify you as a person and kind of move all the way around you to capture a complete 360 degree video of you. Something that I have done with one of these that I thought was a lot of fun was have it follow me and then get on my bike and ride down a trail near me and get a really great like perspective video. There aren't a lot of competing drones that are this capable without quite a bit of like foreknowledge. This is the closest thing to a microwave easy to use in my experience.
Okay. As easy to use as a microwave. I will challenge you to that. I'll buy one and I'll struggle and
Allow
I'll
me to
come.
show you my very complicated microwave.
Okay, got it. Lastly, you have one other suggestion for kids. Consider getting them AirPods. Why are you recommending that? I mean, why not, I guess.
AirPods are, they're incredibly popular. They're quite durable. I would recommend being very careful with which set of AirPods you buy, depending on the kind of kid you're buying them for. Right now, you can get a set of AirPods 4 that sound pretty reasonable and they have really nice battery life. And you can get them from anywhere from like $60 to $75, depending on what retailer you get them for, which is a great price for a nice set of earbuds. However, the very simple base version of AirPods, they're very easy to lose. They pop out at pretty much the easiest inconvenience. They're not really ideal for people who are super active. You can't like go running with these, in my experience. They are really great for sitting down. If you are already in the Apple ecosystem, if you already have an iPhone or an iPad or something like that, they're very easy to use. What I would recommend is if you are giving these to a younger person who is prone to losing things, because these are quite difficult to find once they have been lost. And I know far too many teenagers who have a single AirPod because the other one was, tossed under a bed and never seen again. So there are other versions of the AirPods, especially the Pro versions, that are quite a bit more expensive and more ideal for maybe an older teenager than someone who is 10 to 12. But those versions use the same tracking system that AirTags use, which means if you have lost one, then you can pull up your phone and it will actually use the Bluetooth connection to show you exactly where they are. Whereas the basic version, the AirPods 4, if you want to find them, they will make a small buzz, but they are earbuds, so that is not particularly loud. And if you have lost them in a couch, you will never hear that sound. Please ask me how I know.
I know, right? Yeah. My daughter's really good at she'll turn up mu her music really loud, like a really loud, annoying song, and she can find her earbud wherever it
Yeah.
has gone. Okay, I wanted to move quickly before we run out of time. You had a couple of gifts for adults that you wanted to touch on. You have a digital picture frame. Is this the Arua? That's another n name I don't know.
Aura, yeah. So,
Aura. Okay.
there are a lot of different companies that make digital photo frames now. You can usually get them for anywhere from, $50 to $200, depending on the model that you're looking for. Aura is typically the one that I recommend because the software for it is really, really simple, and it's something that multiple people in the family can be a part of. The Aura frame that lives at my grandparents' house, each one of the, kind of older grandkids has the ability to send photos to that frame from wherever they are. So instead of waiting until the end of a trip or something like that, it's actually quite easy to call a family member who has one of these frames, while you are on a trip, and they can actually look, directly at this large screen while you're talking to them, and you can add new photos as it's happening, which is a lot of fun. But it also means that you, as the person managing it, can control, what pictures are in the rotation and you know how they are displayed in a way that can be really rewarding for the person that you're showing them to.
So this is Aura, A-U-R-A, for people who want to look
That's
it up.
Right.
The Russell recommended digital picture frame. There's a lot out there. I have bought for family members annoying digital picture frames that are hard to upload the photos to after the first time. So is this one going to be easier on me?
This one's way easier. If you've got the Aura app on your phone, which you can share with anyone in a family, then it is very easy to add photos.
Okay. And it's reasonably priced?
They start at about $100. And depending on the size of the frame you want and some of the additional features, they can be more expensive. But they're, this time of year, usually pretty well discounted.
And then you also recommend as a gift for an adult getting someone AirTags. Tell me, or a tile tracker. So tell me why you recommend that. I have AirTags and I know why. I lose things.
Yeah, I'm a clumsy person. I lose things constantly. I have family members who lose things constantly. Mm-hmm. AirTags on a set of keys or attached to a bike or something like that. It's low cost. The batteries need to be replaced like once every 2 years. And they're very easy to drop in a stocking. If you are not, embedded in the Apple ecosystem, I would actually recommend Tile trackers. One of my favorite things that Tile makes is actually a tracker that is the shape of a credit card. So it just gets, put in your wallet. And if you are like me and misplace your wallet on a regular basis, it makes it so much easier to find. The Tile system and the AirTag system are roughly equivalent as far as tracking where things are. I always have an AirTag in my checked luggage, for example, when I have to check a bag, and it makes finding that luggage or knowing that it has actually arrived at its destination a great deal easier. Usually you can buy a 4-pack of these for under $80, which makes them really great to, give one out to 4 different family members.
Yeah, but it is a good gift idea because someone might not want to buy them for themselves, but now you're like, hey, you'll never lose your keys again. I want to say thank you to Russell Hawley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. Thank you so much for your time today, Russell.
Thanks for having me.
This has been Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.